8:15 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Deconstruction on the historic Star Hotel began this week. In the studio to talk about the history of the building, I have Park City Planner Hannah Tyler, along with Park City History Museum Executive Director Sandra Morrison. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So the Star Hotel is going to be reconstructed back to its 1920s form, but the history of the structure goes a lot further back than that. Hannah, can you talk to us a little bit about the earliest version of the Star Hotel?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting site for Old Town and Main Street specifically. In 1889, there was a single-family dwelling built on that site, and it was a crosswing cottage, much like what you'd see on Park Avenue. And so that structure eventually had the Star Hotel added onto it in the 1920s. And prior to that addition, Joe Grover owned the property, and he was a prominent Chinese immigrant, and I think Sandra will touch on that in a second. But it was actually a Spanish family that ended up putting on the 1920s addition, and that's why you see that Spanish Revival sort of exterior design on it. And so what you actually see, though, is you still see that historic single family dwelling in the back of the structure. And so when you see the reconstruction, and hopefully, you know, the next year, we'll be able to actually read that there is a single family dwelling in the back with the Star Hotel addition on the front that will reflect the 1920s and then the 1889 in the back. And so it's a really, I think it's a really great opportunity for us to continue to tell the story of Main Street and how we would develop and get more lodging on Main Street and things like that. And so I think it's a great partnership between the city, the museum, in our efforts to get research on this site, and also, you know, the property owner to, you know, take reconstruction seriously and get the entire structure back.
Explain to us just what does reconstruction mean? Does everything come down?
Yes. So what we've done is we went through the site with the contractor and the architect to identify pieces that could be saved. For example, the entire basement area where Carlene's once was, we all probably recognize that as having stucco on it, but underneath that was the old foundation, which was stone. And again, something even more fascinating about this site is that stone was there when the 1889 house was there. They used the existing wall from 1889 to build the foundation for the 1920s addition. And so we're going to be bringing all that back. And yesterday we were out there documenting as they were taking that stone to Browns Canyon to store. They had numbered it all and taken photos. And so we're hopeful that we will be able to put that back together exactly like it should look.
Okay, but we're also going to be requiring, because of new building code, an actual footing and foundations, and that what just
Correct.
Goes on the inside of that?
Yes, so I believe that this will be applied in more of a veneer fashion, and so you'll have a safe building and it'll meet codes, and I think there are some exceptions you can have when you have a historic building, so we can still make sure that it looks like it should. So we've worked with our chief building official and building department in general just to make sure that we can get a structure that looks exactly like it did in the 1920s, but still meets the code today.
Okay. So any other remnants, though, that must remain with the building other than that rock wall?
I think at this point, I mean, it was so far gone based on the 1970s additions and the stucco applied. There was new stucco applied in the 70s to the old stucco, and so we'll make sure we work with them on a proper stucco that matches what we would have seen in the 1920s. But in terms of salvageable materials, a lot of it had been replaced over the years.
Yeah, so how different will it look from what we saw last week?
Well, that's exactly it. Is what you saw last week was a 1975 alteration, and so there's a series of historic photographs and several staff reports, and as well as some of the press releases that the city has put out, and so you'll see a tax photograph from what we think is maybe the late 1930s or early 1940s, and it'll look like that photo. There's a historic car in it, as well as an individual's arm with a number holding out a plaque. So that's what it will look like.
Okay. Will it be bigger? I mean, right, if they want it to, you know, actually get their money on it, they need to have rooms, right? It's going to be a bed and breakfast or something like that? Or?
No, my understanding is that it's going to be a restaurant, and then there'll be some space to expand upstairs. And so what in terms of getting any bigger, is they're going to be reconstructing it in the exact dimensions as it should be. And we worked really hard, and that was, you know, part of the previous preservation planner and I, we were able to get together and really work with the architect and measure it out specifically. And so all that's being added is a 68 square foot addition in the back. And so this is a really rare example of a complete reconstruction. We'll see the entire structure in hopefully a year.
Yeah, it's essentially a new building.
Correct.
Yeah. Sandra, a few years ago, the structure was designated as historically significant, meaning that it couldn't be demolished. But isn't this a demolition?
Yes, except it went for obviously through a different process that the chief building official basically put a notice on it saying that it was a, you know, public safety hazard. And I guess, you know, the concern was it, you know, might collapse. There's a few of those in town. The Centennial across the street is in the same condition. And I guess it just indicates that, you know, the longer we take to resolve these cases, the worse, you know, the more they deteriorate. And, you know, maybe it's time to start looking at, you know, some other methods that might be available to the city to move preservation projects forward and in a more timely manner. I mean, it's the same situation we're seeing with the historic mining structures at the ski resorts as well. I mean, it's just years of neglect.
Does the Historic Society have a position on the replica of historic buildings or historically significant buildings?
Obviously, replica is sort of your last choice, yeah. Because, you know, you're losing the original materials, you're losing the original construction techniques. But, of course, you want a safe building as well. So, you know, it's a compromise. And the more deterioration, the more compromise.
Yeah. So you kind of just reluctantly go along with
I mean, it's gone through the process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I applaud Hannah on all the work she did. When I first started researching the Star Hotel and I saw there was a tea cottage on the site, I just assumed that got demolished to build the hotel. You know, why would you add on to a tiny house? Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the
really interesting story. Yeah.
In addition, once it moved from a single-family home, what are some of the other owners and uses of the...
Well, no, actually, you know, once the Allendes purchased it in the 30s, it pretty much stayed a boarding house. You know, they owned it right up until the 70s, which is an incredibly long time for somebody to own a property in Park City. So they had a long history here. And, it, you know, and obviously saw a lot of ups and downs. You know, I always wonder about the Star Hotel addition happening in the 20s, and that is when... Grover Senior and his son Joe Grover owned the buildings. His dad died in 1926, and he inherited the property. And so the question was, and the Allendes didn't actually purchase it until the 30s. So was this change of use into a boarding house in addition a partnership between Joe Grover and the Allendes? They were actually operating the Alaska House up the street, which is still standing today. But yeah, it's a, you know, the change in law in 1901, the state allowed miners not to have to live. They passed the boarding house bill, which basically said that miners could live at boarding houses in town instead of up at the mines. And so a number of boarding houses were built at the top of Main Street, the Imperial Hotel next door, which is now Provisions, and the Centennial across the street, and the Alaska House. So, you know, we have quite a history of large buildings suddenly being built to accommodate the employees.
Yeah. So when reconstructing an historic building, what kind of care needs to be taken so that you can preserve as much as possible?
Well, I mean, like Sandra said, is that this went through a whole process, and so part of that process is working with the design team that's on the project to make sure that their plans are exactly replicating what was there. And in this case, obviously, we'd seen a structure that had been altered over the years, and so we were trying to go back to an era that we didn't necessarily have in front of us. And so it really was sort of, I don't know, not a scavenger hunt, but it really was a joint effort with the museum to find these photos and find this information so we could figure out what it's supposed to look like. And so this one's kind of unique in that we didn't really have much to go off of on site besides, you know, existing altered conditions.
Yeah. So in terms of continuing roles, I know, of course, the city will be on site just to, because of permit checks and things like that. Does the museum have any further role as this?
You know, whatever we needed, of course, our history library at the museum has extensive archives and historic photograph collection, and Hannah's spent hours and hours working with us, you know, determining what's appropriate for this building. So, you know, we continue that partnership.
Yeah. So a lot of history research that has gone into this, in addition to just the planning and building process. In terms of the impacts that people will see on Main Street? What's the mitigation plan for that?
You know, obviously, as if anyone had an opportunity to go look at the deconstruction yesterday, you noticed that the road was closed. It is my understanding that that shouldn't be happening past today, and so they're trying to get that site cleaned up. I think the demolition overall went really well, and so they were able to get it cleaned up a lot quicker than I think anyone had anticipated. And so I think they're, with this, you know, weather, it's making it even more difficult, and with the times the dump is open, it's a little difficult sometimes to get trucks down there, especially with weather like this. And so, I mean, we appreciate all the Main Street business owners working with us in this time, and I think we're going to hopefully get this thing across the finish line today, and then normal construction process will occur, and there will be only, you know, partial lane closures, but not a full road closure.
Yeah, well, they have the top, the brew pub parking lot then for mitigation or parking or anything like that?
You know, I'm unsure of where the construction staging is, but that is a public parking lot, and so I anticipate there'll still be some public parking in that area.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to tell us a little bit about the building?
No, I just, you know, it's fascinating that it was owned by, you know, one of the few Chinese people that were still living in Park City in the 30s. Certainly, we had a large Chinatown right here in this area, now called Sweet Alley. But a lot of those, after the Great Fire of 1889, you know, they lost everything. Their homes were burned to the ground, and they didn't have any insurance. And so a lot of them left at that time. So,
yeah. So will I have you here? Is the museum doing anything with regard to the promontory, the Golden Spike celebration?
So, yeah, I think we're going to have a lecture on May 1st with the photo curator from Utah State. He's going to give us, he just published a book on A.J. Russell's photographs. Of course, A.J. Russell was with the Transcontinental Railroad with the Union Pacific, and that was mostly built by the Irish. But came through Summit County, so down Echo Canyon and to the town of Echo. And then on May 8th, Wednesday, the Big Boy steam engine is heading to Ogden for the celebration on May 10th, the joining of the rails, but it's going to stop in Echo, I think at 9:15 in the morning for 15 minutes. And so the county's planning a big celebration in the town of Echo, and so encourage everybody to drive out and see the Big Boy. Yep, and, you know, enjoy sort of history in the remaking.
Right? Yeah, yeah, so any exhibits at the museum?
We're actually getting the exhibit that's currently down at the state capitol, but not till the end of the year. So Utah State and the Golden Spike National Monument put together this exhibition, and it's at the state capitol till June or July, I think, and then it goes to southern Utah, and then it will come to Park City.
So. Okay. All right, Sandra Morrison and Hannah Tyler, thanks for your time
this
morning. 8:32 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, the director of the Summit County Health Department, Rich Bowler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the legislative update. The county, I know, worked hard to get a sewer septic bill passed. What does this mean for Summit County Health Department?
Well, it's actually a big win. So, as you know, we've got several neighborhoods in the county that have failing septic systems, pretty high densities of septic systems. And in any given year, let's say that maybe 10% of them fail. So for us to form an assessment area, a voluntary assessment area, to try to get sewer there is real difficult because there isn't a majority that are experiencing problems at that given point in time. And so what this bill did, in essence, is it increase the protest level to 70% of home ownership. So that means that if we were to go in and try to form an assessment area in the past, 40% of the neighborhood could have blocked that assessment. Now it takes 70%. The important, that sounds pretty heavy-handed, so it's really important to point out that this bill only applies to forming an assessment area to address environmental hazards that are related to wastewater, and specifically to septic. So we have to have years of data. We have to present those data to the Board of Health. The Board of Health would then make a recommendation to the County Council and in other communities, the governing body, and then they would determine whether or not to form the assessment area. So in other words, it's just a tool that we can use if we have an emergency to move forward to get sewer to these areas.
So we had heard from County Manager Tom Fisher that you'll basically be able to kind of mark critical areas? And those are, I think we're talking about Silver Creek, Highland Estates, Hidden Cove. Where else?
In the western side, Timberline, and then up a little bit above Hidden Cove is Moose Hollow. And I want to stress, we don't have, those neighborhoods don't have targets on them. In essence, this just provides us a tool that if we have evidence moving forward that there needs to be sewer there, it actually benefits the neighborhood because we are able to run sewer through this process. Interestingly, the legislature, I've never heard of a bill passing unanimously through every step of the process. Every committee and the House and the Senate passed this unanimously. And so I think it was clear to them that this isn't a process that can be abused. It's a process that, in fact, can maintain property values, allow people to stay in their homes. We're not going to be out there condemning properties. And so it's really a win-win all the way around.
So what areas are we looking then on the east side of the
county? We don't have the same density. There aren't any big neighborhoods like that on septic. And as you know, we've put in policies to try to avoid that moving forward.
So at what point would you go into one of these areas then and say, you know what, it's going to happen?
We've got to have, as I said, years of data. So we have to have evidence that those septic systems are failing at a high enough rate in a high enough density that it is affecting either the groundwater or the surface water. And so the fact that both Silver Creek, and I'm talking about the creek itself, and East Canyon Creek are considered impaired waters, and they are critical tributaries of the Weber, that would suggest that those are two areas in particular that we're going to keep an eye on. Hidden Cove has had problems for years, and we've in essence been putting Band-Aids on those problems house by house. This hopefully in the future would allow us, and again, we would have data, we would be meeting with the homeowners, associations, et cetera. But it would provide us a tool to help them address some of those issues. By them, I mean the neighborhood and the homeowners.
Yeah. How difficult is it to get into an area like Hidden Cove? I mean, a steep, mountainous area, and put sewer in?
Really difficult and really expensive. I believe there were some mistakes made in the past. There were neighborhoods that were permitted to be on septic systems. And at that point in time, that's when the line should have been drawn and we should have been doing sewer. Now we're left with, as Mike Luer says, having to go in and blow a neighborhood up basically to get the sewer in. You dig up all of the streets, you dig through people's yards. It is an expensive and certainly an inconvenient process.
And who pays?
Ultimately, the homeowners. But what this does, an example is Lower Silver Creek. If you recall, a few years ago, we were able to secure funds from the State Water Board to upfront fund getting sewer to Lower Silver Creek. Now, the business and homeowners in that lower part of the area are paying that back. But what it does, this allows us to form the assessment area so that they pay into it over a long period of time. That can be 20 or even 30 years. And so the annual payments are not prohibitive. Longer term, over those years, the payment is not actually very much more expensive than replacing a sewer system or a septic system. So it's it really is a win-win. It allows them to pay over time instead of paying $20,000 to $25,000 to put an advanced septic system in, all in one fell swoop. They get to pay over, say, 20 years.
So how many more years of data collection do you need before we can start getting into
it? Well, we haven't even started yet. And so I anticipate, we have very rudimentary data, but nothing that meets the standard that we're talking about here. So I anticipate it'll be probably 3 years before we start having the conversations with the Board of Health.
All right, so 3 years of data would be then enough to okay. Let's see. And is the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District ready to take on all those new areas?
Yes. They're an impressive organization. They have actually already planned ahead. They have the capacity. They, in some cases, have draft designs for those systems, and so they're well ahead of the process. We've met with them to discuss basically whether or not they can take this on, and they haven't even hesitated.
Okay. Let's see. We're mostly done with the winter weather as we see it snow outside, but, you know, the wood-burning fireplaces, the idling vehicles, the inversion that winter brings with it. Do we have any results on this winter's air quality monitoring?
We do. Phil Bondurant briefed me last night on this. The air was good this year. Part of that, as you know, is we had storms. When we have storms, the air is good. We did have a few spikes, but they were really kind of transient. They didn't last. We didn't have any elevated PM2.5 over a period of time that met any sort of the federal, met this federal standard. So, you know, things were good this year. That doesn't mean that if we have a year when a high pressure builds and stays over us for weeks at a time, that we won't have issues. I would anticipate we would.
Yeah. So we just got lucky. Is that what you're saying? That we had the winter that we did?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, I would like to add that we are working to make sure that we maintain the good air quality that we have. So we still have the big air monitors that we've had in the past, the ones that meet federal standards. And then, as you know, we've put in a purple air network, and the community has also put in, added to that. Purple Air is a small transportable monitor that allows people to have their own station at their own house. It does not measure ozone, so they don't do anything for summer pollution, what is typically summer pollution. And we are observing, they're highly responsive. For example, if somebody idles by one, you're going to have a peak, and we've seen that. It's important to point out that for us to actually begin to approach or violate federal standards, that's over a running average. And we're not seeing that with these monitors. We're seeing a spike for an hour, and then it goes back down. So we're viewing those right now really more as an education tool, and then kind of seeing where it grows.
Okay, back underground. Any updates with regard to a cemetery? Is that something that the health department regulates or no?
Well, so we obviously would have some role in it because of groundwater. So I don't have any updates. I've not been in the loop on that discussion. Years past, we went out and did perk tests on some properties, and then the conversation kind of, pun intended, I guess, died.
Okay.
Don't have info.
What about any update with regard to the impacts of the new medical marijuana law?
Right now, it's a little bit wait and see. We're working behind the scenes to identify what we think would be a good location. It may still be the Quinn's building, but we have a few specifics that we need to meet. We believe it needs to be near a population center. We absolutely believe it needs to be on public transportation. It needs to be an area that we can secure, and it needs to be an area that the public can easily access and be aware of. So the things that come to mind, obviously, are areas like Kimball Junction. But we're still looking at Quinn's. We're beginning a process to put in some prep plans. We're doing this kind of behind the scenes right now because we're still waiting to see ultimately what happens with the challenge to the bill that was passed, and that bill is being challenged. So we don't want to be caught unprepared. So we're putting in place a process.
And any further update from the federal government if the county's role as a dispensary, medical marijuana dispensary, impacts its funding?
No. We're also concerned, the governor wrote a letter to the Justice Department, and that letter was asking for protections, but he did not name specifically funding. He also did not name specifically local health officials or local government officials. So we remain wary and are still waiting for those assurances.
Right. Whether or not, because it's against federal law.
It is.
Yeah. That would basically make the state culpable.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the health officers, there's 13 of us across the state. we're all taking a similar approach. You know, our intent is to make sure that the public is provided the medications that they need. But we want to do it within the construct that it doesn't threaten our core mission, which of course includes funding to provide public health services. So we're all preparing, but we're also waiting for more assurances, and we're waiting to see how the challenge to the bill unfolds.
Okay. In the meantime, though, you're just moving forward as if you need to get this done. What, 2020
yes.
is what we're
correct.
Talking, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And then also, Saul, I think the federal government giving the assurances to the state with regard to the Medicaid expansion bill that was passed. So I guess that's good news for you?
Well, it is good news. You know, it's still at 100% of poverty, though. And I think public health in general advocates for 138%. We certainly do. It would benefit a significant proportion of our population. We've run some data in years past that suggests 138% would cover a critical population that is involved in some of the areas like drug court, like law. You know, they have encounters with law enforcement, and I don't mean to be placing judgment here, but specifically I'm talking about single men. It would significantly expand coverage to them. We need this not just for physical health, but especially, I believe, for mental health and substance abuse treatment. And so for us, it's critical that it be fully expanded.
Okay. And then finally, you have posted a new position for behavioral health director. Is it just a name change, but because of the change, you have to go through the whole...
Well, it's the position that's currently held by Aaron Newman, mm-hmm. But that is a coordinator-level position, and it is time-limited. And so it was approved initially on a 12-month contract. We then moved Aaron to a two-year time-limited employment, full-time employment. We have reclassified the position from coordinator to director, and we want to make it permanent. So we've advertised it both internally and externally, and we anticipate holding interviews next week.
Okay. And you had received funding then in this year's budget for that?
Correct. Yep. And it is... I will tell you, it is a very critical position around all of the behavioral health efforts that we're initiating and carrying out.
Yeah. The job pretty much stays the same. It's just a title change and permanent.
Full-time. It stays the same, but to be honest with you, it's grown a lot. Initially, we brought the position on primarily to design and implement the strategic plan. It's now grown to managing contracts and looking at networks. And it absolutely is a director level, has a lot of responsibilities, and has enormous consequence, good and bad, whether we do it right or we don't. And so it's a critical position for what we're doing.
Okay. When does that person get named?
You know, I can't say that, but just because I don't know. If we do interviews next week, I would anticipate probably 2 weeks.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it.
All right.
I appreciate you having me in.
All right. Thank you,
Austin.
Rich. That's the director of the Summit County Health Department, Rich Bolo. You're listening to the Stanova Basin Planning Commission met last night on the phone with a recap of some of the business discussed. I have Commissioner Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning.
The two items for Silver Creek Village approved pretty quickly. Commissioners approved a subdivision plan and a final site plan for Lot 9, which approves 64 apartments there rather than a mix of townhomes and apartments that was originally approved. Now, this was done after Mountainlands Community Housing Trust says that it wasn't economically feasible to do townhomes because of the rising construction costs. So what are the chances that townhomes will be built later?
From what they said last night in discussions, there's a chance that they're not. It doesn't sound like they entirely have the rest of the plan, that things may be somewhat in flux in some of the other parcels. So they stated that they couldn't say at this point whether or not townhomes, affordable townhomes, would come back or not. I know that with Mountainlands, they're really trying to provide additional affordable housing on a bunch of different levels for the community to fill that gap. And I know that's their top priority. And from what they said right now, the most feasible option for them is to change to apartments and condos.
Okay. So the plan for Silver Creek Village calls for 330 affordable units in total. Are we on track to achieve that?
Right now, from what I understand, that they're just about to break ground. And as far as their development agreement is concerned, there's certain benchmarks that they have to reach per how many total units that they build. So with the plan that is in place and what they've stated, they will be in compliance with their development agreement and on track for all of the units that have been promised within the development agreement for affordable housing.
All right. A subdivision plat for the Florence Gilmore property approved also quickly. In the presentation from Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas, what uses might we see in Lot 1? This is the 125 acres, essentially clean dirt there.
So in the general plan, that was an area that was looked at for a mixed-use type purpose. Currently, we're reviewing some changes to ordinances that would allow a couple of mixed-use zones. That hasn't currently been approved, and so we're still looking and seeing what that will be. It really depends on who the county develops with and what they envision it at, but it sounds like it's intended to be some sort of mixed use, or there's probably varied use, at least within that parcel.
And how does this tie into the adjacent triangle parcel that was purchased by Summit County as open space?
From what Dave Thomas was explaining to us last night, that parcel currently is owned by partially Summit County and partially Basin Recreation District. And within that basin, once the Gilmore property is secured as part of that, Basin Recreation will purchase the county's portion of the triangle parcel to secure it for recreational uses moving forward.
All right. Let's see. In terms of the Snyderville general plan, what's the vision for the Highway 40 frontage road?
Well, I don't have the plan right in front of me, but I know that there are specific parcels within the general plan when they went through several years ago with the community that were identified as key parcels for mixed-use areas. Right now, a lot of that area is zoned either rural residential or community commercial. And so, again, it would really depend to get a zone change, and would go through an entire process, and that would be something we'd have to address when we got there.
Okay, let's talk a little bit. I mean, I know that you have looked at the mixed-use zone. How far are we away from actually adopting something?
You know, I'm not sure when it's coming back onto our calendar as far as looking at it, but we had a community member that has also introduced a proposal for a mixed-use zone as part of a specific process. So it sounds like that has been expedited a little bit from my understanding as far as whether or not that will be approved. We should have a better idea of that within the next few months.
Okay. Let's see, the longest discussion last night about a project at the Canyons, I think it's called the Waite subdivision. The applicant wants to amend the plat so that the development can be allowed primary access onto Red Pine Road. Can you give me a better idea where the project's located?
So the project is located next to what's in the Escala parcel, from what I understand is where Sunrise currently is. And originally the parcel in question, the Waite property, was part of the Escala parcel. Several years ago, they, I believe 2012, divided that into two separate parcels. But on the parcel, it was stated that they still had to use the access through the Escala because it was intended to be developed in conjunction still with that, the Escala parcel.
Yeah, so it sounds like due to some convoluted history, the project is left without a road access?
From what we gathered, that there is no clear road access currently from what it states within their agreement, that it was supposed to go through the Escala parcel, but I don't believe that there's a road access that has been set aside for that.
Some neighbors turned up to object that the change would impact them and cause a traffic burden there on Red Pine. So the commission voted to continue the item. What, just to get some more information? Or
there were several pieces of information that we wanted to gather regarding some additional history. We wanted to listen to the 2012 conversation from the Planning Commission at that time, as none of the current commission were present during that time. We also wanted to get some further history and legal opinion regarding if in the sale of the Waite property, if that wasn't considered, if the public has an obligation to then provide that, if that was something that, that they had missed. So we're looking into a bunch of different things, as well as a traffic study to look and see what the traffic burden will increase to on that road. Also, the applicant didn't have a clear idea of what they would want to build or how much of the density on that parcel they'd be able to use because of setbacks and other stipulate height regulations and stipulations. So we wanted a better idea as far as the actual density that they could potentially build on that parcel.
So will there be a traffic study required? Or
from what I understand, that is what we requested. So that's what we were expecting, is a traffic study. What exactly the extent and what that looks like, I'm not sure. I'd have to defer to the community development director, but we did request a traffic study for that.
Okay.
That portion of the road.
Anything else you want to mention, Melina?
That we just really appreciate all the community coming that came last night and their input, and appreciate all of the staff and the work that's gone into all these projects.
All right. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:56.